Big week. This is a big week at Fits and Starts, episode number 17. Welcome back to Fits and Starts. We have some really super exciting guests coming up, and we've had exciting guests, but now we have super exciting guests. So this week on the show, we have Mr. Neil Dash, who is a preeminent force on the internet and founder of several amazing things. Daniel, you want to give a little bit of background on him?
Yeah, so Neil Dash is a blogger from way back, and who I first heard of on some podcasts when I was just a teenager running around with an iPod Nano in Tokyo. He is currently the CEO of Fog Creek Software, who has been responsible for things like Fogbugs, Trello, Stack Overflow, things you've heard of. A lot of those are spun off into their own companies now, and now their primary product is Glitch, which is basically programming in multiplayer.
And are we talking about any of our other Rockstar guests on the show, or are we keeping that a secret?
I think we can talk about it. So
we got a big one.
Yeah, we got a bunch of big ones sort of coming down the pike, but we're just going to tease next episode. We have Merlin Mann. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Merlin Mann.
You've heard of him. He's an all-around podcaster, man about the internet. He used to be Merlin Mann. We're going to have him on the show, and this is a huge deal for us.
He's sort of a spiritual mentor of the show, and now we can actually call him a friend of the show because he's been on the show. So you'll hear him in a couple weeks. Because of that, because of some of our other exciting stuff coming up, I just want to say there's never been a better time to subscribe. If you're not already subscribed to the show, if it's your first time listening, the button is right there. It's sitting on your screen. Just push the button. Just subscribe to the show.
Push the button. Yeah, it's awesome. And we have, you know, we're doing a lot of things around here to kind of like up the level of the show a little bit. We feel like we've done well, but now that we're getting these guests on who are so far out of our league, we figured it would be nice to, you know, make this
start to pretend to be professional podcasters.
Yeah, we're going to make this house a home. And so to do that, we have, contracted our friend of the show again, Kara Mask, an excellent designer, from Baltimore. To create the artwork that you are seeing in your feed. So if you like the little Rubik's Cube artwork you're seeing, thank Kara. Go check her out.
Bonus points if you can identify what all those shapes are.
Yeah, so we're doing our part around here to make this a good podcast. So if you would go subscribe to the show, and if you're feeling real generous, go rate us on iTunes, because that's how people are going to find us. That would be awesome.
If it's physically painful to shill like this.
Oh my god, it really sucks. Like, I can get into the excited voice for the sake of asking people to do things, but it hurts my soul for the rest of the day.
It actually hurts my soul too. I'll cut all this out.
A lot about sort of the open web as a concept. I think the most recent thing you wrote was on Medium. And so I'm really interested to kind of hear you talk about, like, because, you know, I'm a web developer, right? So I write code for the web. I've got a lot of friends who are iOS developers, and they're always trying to sway me with the siren song to come be an iOS developer, you know, I kind of have this weird love for the web.
Yeah. I mean, the web gave me everything I have in my life, like my job, my career, and indirectly is how I met, you know, my wife and most of my friends. So like, I can't not be loyal to it. Like, it is still, you know, I've built iOS apps and I've built, you know, whatever, like, I'm not against it, but like, what is the thing that opened every door for me? It is the web, and to have a feeling like that about the web is actually, I think these days, feels pretty old-fashioned, right?
Yeah.
And what I realized was a couple things, but in that era, you know, let's call it the Web 2.0 era, right? Like, back when there was the Web 2.0 conference and everybody was talking about open data and whatever, and there was this, well, one, we had this sort of pretense that everybody in the industry knew what we meant by open, but of course, open meant a lot of different things, because, you know, like, as soon as Google realized they were way behind iOS, they open sourced Android. And of course, you know, in many ways, it was just a tactic. It was just a way to get distribution and to have Google be on most of the phones of the world, and it worked. So like, open source, yeah, it was good, but it was also this business tactic that we had thought at the time meant you were intrinsically good and positive and helping the world. And it's like, it turns out it's just like another way to distribute software. Yeah. And you can make it good, you can make it bad, you can make it anything in between. And so that was really an insight I didn't have at the time. And then the other part was, you know, we felt, okay, well, because we are open source and the formats by which you share a photo or add a friend on a social network are open, then we're better and we're more open, and that's the way the internet's supposed to work. And so, of course, you know, like I said, I look very derisively at a closed network like MySpace or later Facebook, because they were totally proprietary and you couldn't add a friend from one service to the other. And I thought that's going to, you know, hamstring them. And of course, I was wrong. And what I realized is the openness that actually mattered in the rest of the world, in the real world, to billions of people, was the ease and simplicity with which they could access a service, get value out of it, and connect to their friends. That is another definition of open that doesn't exist on the technical realm at all. And that I really missed in my own, you know, hubris. And I think that was a really humbling realization, to realize like Zuckerberg was, in the most meaningful ways, more open than all of the open source efforts we had ever done.
Right. It's like, as soon as you link me to a GitHub readme, you've already closed out, you know, 90% of people.
That's right. So much of the dependencies were like, step one, run a web server on the internet. Yeah. Step two, install this incredibly complex software. We're like, why isn't everybody doing it? It's so open, you know.
Right.
You know, and for me, it was particularly egregious because, you know, my parents are immigrants to the U.S. I was born here, but I would regularly go back and visit family in India when I was a kid. And most of my cousins still live there. And so, you know, we're from one of the poorest regions of India. And I think of my cousins working in the rice paddy in India, in an area where, like, the Aboriginal tribes that live around there, a family of four lives on $600 a year to $800 a year. And, you know, I really do understand that context. I lived there for months at a time as a kid without running water, without electricity. And here I was being like, why doesn't everybody just run a web server? Like, it was
even assuming I had a web server to run, like, you know, like, I can't even get electricity, like, reliably.
Right. Like, so the chain of dependencies was so enormous. And then, you know, you fast forward to today, and they're all on WhatsApp, you know, which is owned by Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, they're not like iPhones, but they're like moderately smartphones, and they can run an app and they can do messaging. Mm-hmm. And I can get a picture of their kids in real time when they have a baby, you know, from the middle of that rice paddy. And I think that's a thing. Well, they probably don't think the baby on the rice paddy, but I think there's this thing that, like, you can be connected. And that was the openness that mattered. And the fact that the electricity wasn't reliable, you know, was routed around by the phone network. But here was what it meant to communicate. Mm-hmm. And they can get prices on, you know, what their crops are growing for in the market and what they're selling for, and they can get ideas about what they have access to in terms of, you know, services at the local villages and all the different stuff that matters to their life. And, you know, meanwhile, we're still like, here's how you set up this open source product. And it just, it missed the mark so completely. And it was one of the great lessons of my life. And so today, if I write something on Medium, I'm like, can they read it? That's open. Can I write it quickly and share it with people? That's open. And can people, most on the margins, least connected to the tech industry, least tied into the old boys network and the technical knowledge that we trap there, have a way to express themselves, communicate, and get some value out of this network? That's the only definition of open that I care about anymore.
Yeah. So the other side of that, though, right, is that as we make these more and more accessible tools and consolidate the control of those tools, we're more and more like dependent on those sort of centralized power hubs to decide what direction the openness goes, right? And all of the controversy surrounding Twitter recently and all of that, you know, I loved what you said on Being, where you said, you know, when they like the results, they're happy to take the credit, but when they don't like the results, Twitter is a neutral tool, right?
Yeah, that's
and
exactly
so
right.
that centralization of power, you know, in Twitter, it's like Twitter is super open. Anybody can be there. Everyone is there. I mean, not everyone's there. It's relatively small.
But millions of people are there.
A lot of people are there, you know, and anybody can be there who has SMS, really, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, like, they get to then decide what that openness means for people, right?
Yeah. And this is true of all the platforms. You can look at YouTube. You can look at, you know, even the bigger scale ones that are, you know, an order of magnitude bigger than Twitter.
Sure.
I guess not an order of magnitude, but certainly multiple times
bigger.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm still enough of a coder that I want to get my terms right.
Way bigger.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you take something like YouTube, and it's like, which sites they curate to show up on the homepage, whether they're manually editing those or have an algorithm doing that, it really decides who wins. And, mm-hmm. you know, Twitter deciding that I get a verified checkmark because I was their friend. And that means now all of a sudden my tweets show up higher in the results when you search for something is them deciding who wins. Mm-hmm. And Facebook's algorithm, you know, choosing which news stories show up when you click on a news headline, is all about them picking winners. And those things are very, very important cultural decisions. They have enormous impact in the same way that what the New York Times puts above the fold on the homepage, you know, on the front of their printed paper, that has real cultural impact. And, you know, it's such an interesting thing where we still, you see in celebrity culture how excited even the biggest stars in the world get about getting a magazine cover. Mm-hmm. Right. So you can be Beyonce, you can be Lady Gaga, and when you're on the cover of Vogue or on the cover of anything, you know, Rolling Stone, they'll tweet it out, they'll put it out on their Facebook, you know, they'll put it out on their social media to be like proof of their cultural relevance. And the reality is, sharing of that cover aside, in terms of people that actually read it, more people see what's featured in the social media stream if Facebook really decided to put a certain story in front of all the people who are interested in it. More people would see it than would see the cover of most print magazines. Hmm. And so it's the same level of a choice as being the, you know, the Time Person of the Year or whatever award you want to get. But we treat it as if it's a neutral thing done by the algorithms and that nobody made that decision and it doesn't have the same prestige.
I guess it was your most recent blog post about fake markets. I thought that was a fascinating, I'll put that in the link to that in the show notes. It's a fascinating kind of assessment of what's going on right now. But it is sort of funny how these companies will make appeals in their language to this kind of like, you know, open and free market mythological language. But you, in your post about openness and fake markets, you sort of out-capitalist the capitalists, right? It's like it's if it's tightly controlled by an organization of kind of a homogenous group of people, that's actually the opposite of open.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting thing because I'm, you know, maybe the most skeptical person of capitalism of any CEO of a successful company. And you know, so it's a weird position to be in, but it's just I have had the good fortune to see both sides of how these systems work for better and for worse. And so I have this, you know, I try to be as complicated as the world is in my views. And, you know, what comes out of that is the sense of like being aware when we have our thumb on the scale, when we're the ones who pick the winners. And I think that idea that we sort of like markets do have a place. I think there's a lot of value. I think there are a lot of great things markets can do if everybody's allowed to participate in them.
Yep.
You know, and I just think of like, you know, clever creators I see on Etsy or smart people selling their stuff on eBay. And I'm like, that is great. Like, I do love that people can sort of find each other and connect around their ideas or what it is they want to share with the world and have that be a really a pretty, you know, level market for people. But that mode applied as a sort of a fig leaf over something that is completely rigged is like, it's a scam, you know, it's such a scam. It's like and I mean, Uber is everybody's, you know, target right now because with good reason, they've sort of transgressed in every way that they can, but they really do exemplify this, that sense of wanting to seem like a market, have all the trappings of a market, or at least enough to trick, politicians who are not tech savvy and yet not really resembling a market in any reasonable way.
Well, it seems like, you know, markets, like you were saying, it's like they can be a helpful tool. It's just we need to be really dead serious about how we set up guardrails. And it seems like the only way to be serious about guardrails is to view markets as something that are not sacred, right?
Yeah, and to recognize the value of them and to be skeptical about them is a rare balance. I haven't found too many people who are notably successful who have that skepticism. And part of it is the sort of survivor bias. Anybody who wins, and by wins we usually mean gets rich, in a market all automatically assumes, well, that market must be fair and just and good because how else would I have won? You know, it's like the game can't possibly be rigged because I'm a good person and good people win.
There's kind of this idea that like the market is like a framework, right? But often I think a lot of people talk about like the market sort of being outside of any framework, like the market is a law of nature, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah,
like you can build whatever framework you want on top of the market, right?
But
I tend to like be a little bit more of a fan of the idea that like you build whatever framework you're going to build, right? And how you think about Marcus ends up, you know, reflecting itself in your framework. And you can be really, really off base, in which case, like, human nature will correct for your wrongness. But, mm-hmm. like, with a basic, you know, with sort of a basic level, you know, if you're kind of right about how humans work, like, you have a lot of influence over how your market plays out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that thing of, like, they aren't this magical, you know, pixie dust that you sprinkle on something and all of a sudden everything becomes fair and everybody makes good decisions. And I think you see this especially where, like, bigger markets, more valuable ones, you see how much the players are trying to mask the information and hide it from you.
Yeah.
So the idea of making an informed decision is impossible, right? And I mean, this is a very fraught one to bring up in the U.S., but I think you talk about, you know, gun violence and people, you know, a lot of Americans talk about how to keep track of gun sales and tracking and how they, you know, go to market and who are the, you know, the distributors that are responsible for guns that are misused. And it sort of actually doesn't really matter how you feel about how to interpret the Second Amendment or where you feel on guns rights. Like there's actually almost nobody who is reasonable disagrees that we shouldn't be distributing guns in ways that are irresponsible, that are, you know, going to people who are sort of known bad actors. So everybody's sort of on the same page there. And you say, and then especially when you find out, okay, it's a very small number of distributors that are responsible for most guns that are misused. You're like, okay, well, that's a mm-hmm. thing where we can pay attention and try to get them to be better citizens. And then you realize they've passed regulation to prohibit the ability to track which guns are sold through a few bad actors. And so you're essentially protecting the worst of, you know, among them. And I would imagine all the other gun retailers have got to feel like, wow, let's get these jerks out of our club, you know, so we don't look bad by association. And of course you can't because of, you know, the way the policy is set up. And this is the kind of thing where like nobody ever talks about this stuff. Cause it's like if a CEO brings this stuff up, it usually is such a hot button that people lose their minds. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, in my case, I just see this, like there's a systemic thing where if the market were what we say it is, which is informed purchasers making smart decisions with lots of really good information amongst a set of, you know, vendors who all provide a pretty fair exchange around the products that they're putting out there, you could actually make really good informed decisions. You can say, I don't want to buy from these unreputable dealers in the market, but you can't have that information, right? So the market is skewed in a way that prevents you from even making an informed decision if you want to be a, somebody that supports the business practices that you agree with. Yeah. That's the sign. And there's so many markets like that, but I think that's like the one really profound example where like we've all agreed it has this very high societal cost. And in fact, I would say the people it hurts most are those who advocate for gun ownership because it undermines their ability to make the argument that, you know, most gun owners are responsible and that there is a place in society for individual citizens to own guns or collect them, because every counterexample comes through a very small number of bad actors. Hmm. Right. And so like there's this thing where we can look at a system and I think that's actually 99% of people in America I could have that conversation with, I just said, and they would probably agree. Mm-hmm. Like there's, you know, there's outliers, but for the most part, overwhelming majority of people agree with like that general framing. And we can't have that conversation about it because we have a market that is a tiny number of corporate extremists have skewed.
Right.
To try and hide that. And I think that's the kind of stuff where like, now that's for the most part, entirely outside the realm of technology. Like Google's not selling guns yet. Apple's not selling guns yet. So like,
yeah, but you have similar things. Like, I mean, even Comcast is doing very similar things right now.
Exactly.
Like and that's what I'm saying, FCC is, forms with, you know, fake user data.
That's right. And so that's what I'm saying. It's like, we can take this example that I want to point out that's totally non-technological or not connected to the tech industry as we understand it today. And make that analogy. Cause it's also something where like, extremely hot button issues that people understand viscerally, even if they don't, you know, they might disagree, whatever, obviously they do, but they have almost nobody doesn't have a feeling about it. Like everybody has an opinion. The difference with the Comcasts of the world, with the sort of, you know, the players in tech that are putting their thumb on the scale on issues like net neutrality, on issues like even just government procurement of technology, like all these very basic things, mm-hmm. is one, the information is still hidden. So that idea that you can't see what they're doing, you don't understand it, you can't make an informed decision. But two, a lot of people aren't well informed enough to have an opinion. Not and that they're ignorant.
Intentionally whatever, they're busy. So on behalf of the companies. Like even the language they're using is so confusing. Mm-hmm. Have you seen all these Twitter ads that Comcast is buying that's like, we won't block, like hashtag we won't block. Like they're using this language that's like, we won't do all these bad things, so don't legislate us against it.
Right, exactly. They're co-opting net neutrality. And right. I think this is sort of classic corporate misinformation. But the problem is, you know, and then the classic way that you would respond to that was you would have the FCC or the FTC regulate the advertisements they were allowed to do in the same way that like the cigarette companies can't say that cigarettes are good for you and a doctor mm-hmm. recommends them anymore, right?
Mm, right.
But even that is like the current environment. You're never going to have that conversation.
Right.
Where we're going to be like, well, Comcast is being intellectually dishonest, therefore we're not going to let them say that in an ad. Like that idea almost sounds like science fiction at this point.
It's ridiculous.
Hey, Neil, can you hear us all right?
Boom.
We're running.
John, you recording?
I'm up and running.
Piece of cake.
Yeah, man.
And so they were like, this is nuts. Like, what kind of science fiction madness is this? Why would I take a picture of my child with my phone and put it on the internet and then have to worry about adding friends as privacy? And, you know, of course, we do all that stuff as a matter of course now. But
so we started asking people who we didn't think we could get. And you were...
And they said no, and then you reached out to me. Perfect. Thanks so much. Yeah, Krista Tippett can bring out the best in anybody, so I feel like I got elevated by talking to her. So I will try to do my best to be as erudite as she makes me.
She's pretty great.
That scene in Tom Sawyer where, you know, he convinces everybody to whitewash the fence.
One of the things that we come back to on this show, one of the kind of recurring themes on here is pretty similar to one of the things that comes up a lot when you talk. You've talked about this a number of places that have been, you know, on YouTube and podcasts and other places that we'll put links to. But kind of this idea of like taking responsibility, being a citizen of the internet, trying to be a good citizen of the internet, and just basically trying to do better and taking some ownership. And one of the ways that we've talked about that specifically on here is with like diversity and inclusion, which is something you've talked at length about. But I'm curious to hear you speak a little bit more about that, just because it's one thing that, you know, we're in our 20s and we are white dudes. And so mm-hmm. we kind of need to face that reality. And we are always trying to look for ways to do better, to be more inclusive, to be, mm-hmm. you know, a voice of sanity. But it's a little tricky sometimes when you're kind of like a young gun at an organization and you're not a manager yet. And I'm curious if you have some ideas of like, how can people like Daniel and me do better?
Yeah, I think it's important. I think there's a couple aspects. I think the first is the like understanding what we mean by diversity, right? Because there's the, obviously there's the visible stuff. There's the stuff we don't talk about as much, like, you know, ageism and these other sort of more subtle isms. And then there's the why. And I think one of the things I really try to push for, and I'm lucky because I have a platform to do that. I can, you know, come talk to you and come talk to other people. And it's that we fall to justifying diversity and inclusion on the grounds of economic benefit. Now, they do have a measurable economic benefit, and that is true. Products do better if they're created by diverse teams. But I don't want us to put the justification for making moral changes to make it dependent on economic arguments.
Hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think about this a lot of like, not to be overly dramatic, but like there were people that could have made the argument that ending slavery was bad for the economy. Mm. Right.
Right.
And so I'm like, I don't care that it was bad for the economy or that you couldn't make an economic case depending on where you sat. So like there are times we do what's right because it's what's right. Now, in this case, it's fortunate that the research shows that this is something that also has an economic benefit.
Right.
But I never want to start with that. And I think we go to that because it's sort of the trump card in our culture is that, well, if it makes money, that proves that you got to do it. And so I always want, like, I'm fine for that to be one of the arguments, but it can never be the fundamental reason that we advocate for those things. So I think that starts from the, like, how do we argue for this? I think the second part is there's been an interesting cultural shift where at least in tech, certainly, everybody knows they at least have to give lip service. They have to say, yes, I'm for it. Right? People have mostly, if they're visible and they're prominent and they're a leader, have stopped saying, I'm not for it. There's some, you know, but for the most part, like anybody, any reasonable person is going to be like, yeah, I'm for diversity and inclusion.
Sure.
And what I hadn't understood for a long time was that that could be a tactic for stalling or even a well-intentioned thing, but they don't actually change anything.
Hmm.
And so I used to give all this, you know, well, I was going to say half credit. I used to give full credit for like, well, they said the thing, they said the nice thing, you know, and they're like, okay, but where's the money? Like you care about money. I'm not saying the economic justification is the only one, but if that is how you indicate what your values are, is by what you spend, and you're making the argument on an economic basis, then what are you spending on? Who are you hiring? Who are you paying? When people do the work of inclusion and diversity, are you paying them for it? Or you ask them to do it on the side on top of their actual day job?
Yeah. And if you're going to talk about equity, where's the equity?
Yes. Right. And who owns what? What's the cap table look like? And so that stuff, all of a sudden, things get real clear real quick.
We're back to revealed preferences there, right?
Yeah. And I've been as guilty of this as anybody, is the sort of say the thing, but don't do the thing. And you know, being in the position now I'm in now, I've been at Fog Creek for, you know, over 6 months, and I'm the CEO. And so we're doing a lot of hard internal work around how do you shift the company culture forward, and how do we invest in long-term making this a welcoming place for a lot more people. And it's a lot different than, you know, career fair night or language that we put on the website.
Hmm.
And that's at a small company. I have a lot of leverage to do that. And we have a lot of interest in, we've always been a very humane organization, a very people centric. And so there's a lot of willingness on the part of the team. But if those things weren't all true, it would be even harder. And that's true at a lot of big companies.
I think a lot of our listenership is millennials who mm-hmm. do care mm-hmm. deeply about this, but mm-hmm. also aren't hiring managers and aren't necessarily setting the culture
right.
of their organization.
And so you want to be a good ally, but you're not the one that sets the budget. You're not right. the one that's hiring. I think there's a couple different ways. I think one of the things to do is, first of all, look to the people in your organization who are part of an underrepresented group and look to what they're doing that is that sort of hard emotional labor and see which parts of that you can take on.
Mm.
You know, there was always somebody who was like, you know, the woman who's a coder who has to be the voice for all women who code at the organization. And, you know, it's just like, what if I don't feel like it today? Mm. What if I don't want to be the one to lecture about it? You know what I mean?
Right.
And so to be able to be of use to her without her asking and just be like, you know, like coordinate, but like this sort of sense of like, I'm going to be the one to raise, like we have this exclusionary language on our marketing page, or we have this event that we're doing that, you know, is all dudes in the lineup or whatever. And sort of be, I think, to be that voice and that advocate and to be in that uncomfortable position sometimes. I think one thing which I try to do a lot of these days is just get out of the way. So when people ask me to speak or they ask me to go to conferences or they ask me to do whatever, my default response now is I have a list of people I refer them to that haven't had that platform that could use that voice or that in the case of like I generally don't get paid for speaking because I'm like, you know, shilling for my company. But when I used to get paid for speaking, would take people who weren't being paid at that level and try to get them the slot so that they could be leveled up and say, like, now I get this much per talk instead mm-hmm. of, you know, my lower rate. And so like and even just like simple things like I, you know, for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years have only retweeted women on Twitter. And it's like not a big deal, but like I have a lot of followers, and so being able to amplify voices and be mindful about who I amplify has been, for me, it's been really rewarding. Like just for me to see how the responses go and the conversations go, but it's also this nice way to be like, if you have a platform, how do you use it? And it's interesting because like those things you can do and people don't really notice until, unless you tell them. Like when I did it for a year before I told anybody that I was only retweeting women, during the year, nobody said anything. And then after I said that's what I was doing, like the dudes all
bunch of people got mad. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How come you're not retweeting me? I was like, you didn't notice before, and also like your tweets aren't that good, so whatever. Yeah. But like, I think that's a real. It's just an interesting thing. So I think like those times when we can be the platform and amplify somebody, is really powerful. Examples of that I would use is like, and this is something that is specific to not being management, not being the HR manager, not being a CEO. Salary transparency benefits workers, period. But it's scary as hell. People are uncomfortable with the idea of their coworkers sitting next to them knowing what they get paid. Yet what almost always comes of it is that people most on the margins find out how they're being underpaid and exactly how much.
Hmm.
And it really benefits them. Now, what people's degree of comfort is with, like, how public, you know, like, do you want to, like, put it on Facebook out for the world, or do you want, you know, do you want to just, like, tell your coworker at lunch or whatever? Like, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but that is a huge way to be a great ally to people on the margins. And what you can do is find people that are, you know, wherever they are in the org chart, or if it's a role that you've had before, or that you know roughly what range it would be in, or you know what you are and can compare, having those conversations with people is incredibly powerful. If you can push all the way to having a broader conversation across your organization of people talking about what they're being paid, that's a huge one. And it's something that I'm discovering, it's really tricky. I can't do top down as a CEO because I don't want to force people to do it. And also I don't, you know, like, I don't want to put, like, I think actually we're, like, as a small company, we're pretty good on this. So, like, I've been reviewing it myself to make sure everybody's being paid fairly. But, you know, if that weren't the case, being able to have people advocate for it is really useful, because it is a very different thing when it's peer-to-peer and from the grassroots up, as opposed to a dictate from the company that you have to tell your salary to the world, which you might not want to do. And so, like, I think those are things that are just incredibly powerful tools that let you use the privilege of your platform, and the fact that, like, honestly, tech workers are amongst the most empowered workers that have ever existed in the world, and we don't really use that power very much. We should. Like, nobody, you legally, you can't be fired for disclosing your salary, but also it would be an incredible story if you were, right? Like, it would actually only make you more valuable as an employee, because people would see that you're the kind of person that's trying to upgrade the whole organization. Like, I'd be, like, walking my dog, and three different people would be talking about podcasting startups.
How to be, like, a decent human being with a job.
Which is not always easy.
Which is so
it's
not
kind
easy.
Of a tall order.
Yeah.
Figure out how to solve a problem, put it out there for free, make an open source version of it, let any company, any size use it, and sort of make the internet better.
What a novel idea.
Well, I remember the first time Mark Zuckerberg came by, and he said, like, at that time, it's like he said six colleges, or, like, whatever.
The often disparaged lifestyle business really is much better for your lifestyle, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing. Like, turns out I want a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Who knew? Like, I'm a loudmouth who likes to say strongly political things online and visibly on Twitter and whatever. Slack, to me, is a very ethical company. And I mentioned them just because, like, I have no ties to them, except I know the people who run it. They're a very ethical company, and they're being very inclusive in their hiring, and they've raised infinite dollars, I don't even know, billions of dollars or something, you know, from top tier VCs. And so, but they're able to hold that, you know, to that line about what they want to be as a company. I think that's a rare exception. I like to think the companies that, like Stack Overflow, where I'm on the board, like that are, you know, holding the line on that. That's also true. But for the most part, most of the companies that have taken a decent amount of money, or that are valued over certain hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, really the only thing they care about is that return for the investors, and that can lead to some really terrible compromises.
If I'm looking at my own personal satisfaction as a human, I want to bootstrap a company, right? But if I'm talking about starting a company that does good in the world, right? There's the utilitarian view of it, which I'm not a utilitarian, but, like, there is this view that says, like, the most good that you can do for the most people is to have the biggest reach, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, A, it almost feels like, you know, the system grinds people down and makes people make certain choices. And so the way I wrote this down in my notes was, is it easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a right, venture-backed yeah. company to put social good over daily active users? Right?
Yes. The answer is yes. The camel has a much better shot. I think the other part is, I look at the reverse, which is, can you have a bootstrapped or alternately funded, because you could do crowdfunding, you can do, you know, other models. Can you have a non-VC backed startup that has material impact, that has major impact on the world?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are ancient examples like Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
And Craig Newmark's a good friend, and I think he's been a great citizen of the world. Like, he really supports a lot of meaningful causes and uses his influence and impact in a good way. And they are still a pillar of the web. They're still enormously influential and do a ton, you know, and enable a ton of good.
Mm-hmm.
And we're never took investment, and we're sort of very thoughtful about their place in the world. And so, like, I think that's been a really interesting model. I think you know, there have been, I think Wikipedia is really interesting. Like Jimmy Wales is an interesting guy. I've known him probably since Wikipedia was founded, and he, you know, he's a libertarian. Like he actually, I disagree with him a lot on like politically and a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. but he understood the civic good, the social good of Wikipedia so much that he made it a nonprofit. And, you know, people can be annoyed at their like NPR fundraiser hand, you know, handout that they think they were like, please give to support Wikipedia. But it's so valuable that he did that. I mean, Wikipedia is probably what, the fourth biggest site in the world, something like that.
I don't know exactly.
And yeah, but it's top five, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, to be up there with Facebook and Google and be like, we're a non-commercial entity and we are not driven by page views. Mm-hmm. And we are not trying to track your data and your information and your identity. It's so valuable and so powerful, and does so much good for the world, and is sort of unremarked upon. And this is sort of this refrain for me is like things that are really, really good that could have been terrible that we don't notice that they aren't. Mm-hmm. And that really just, that jumps out to me of like, there was so much good in Jimmy choosing to make Wikipedia a non-commercial model. And so like, that's something, and it's not like, you know, the people who run it are like paid. There's lots of volunteers, but like, yeah, there are people that they get paid and they raise money and they pay and keep the servers on. And like, I have to imagine that team finds their work immensely satisfying given the good they do for the world. Hmm. And I have a lot of criticisms of Wikipedia too, but like, I have like not nearly as many as I have of every other company that has the size site that they have. And so I think like there are these models that we think of as like atypical, but like, you know, the web without Craigslist, the web without Wikipedia, the web without, you know, Mozilla and other sort of similar models, wouldn't be as good a place. And even with Stack Overflow, like, you know, it's a commercial entity. They make a lot of money. They have a very good model, but like the content is owned by the people who submit it. Mm-hmm. And you can do a lot of like really, really good things without even registering for the site, let alone, you know, paying money or whatever else. And so it's not an extractive model and they're not doing a lot of, you know, sort of bad user behaviors. I think those are the things that like, that's the internet I love, and it's possible to do. And Stack, I mean, I think, you know, they took funding to be able to expand more and do whatever, but like could have been bootstrapped. The others were bootstrapped pretty much. And so I think there, I still have this ideal, like if I could wave my magic wand for Glitch, it would be that we become big enough to be meaningful as a way that people build apps in the world and share them with each other and create and collaborate together, while bootstrapping a model that lets the community feel like they really have the say ultimately over what the product is in the world and how it works, so that it's accountable in a way to everything that they value and everything that they create.
I love it.
Wish us luck.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I don't know, somewhere along the lines, like my heartstrings got tied up in the sort of Jimmy Wales, Cory Doctorow side of the mm-hmm. web, you know, and those guys are yeah. my guys, you know, and like,
and also to come up in that cohort of, you know, watching that stuff happen, watching the you know, the birth of like Creative Commons, of these open formats, all these things that happened together. There were people who made a name for themselves, as Cory did, as Jimmy did, as so many people did, by representing a set of values about how we talk to each other, how we communicate with each other, how we connect to each other, mm-hmm. Is something that should be intrinsically part of what the internet is to people, part of what the web is to people. And that idea, it just seems increasingly anachronistic, but I'm not yet willing to let it go.
When you think about it, right, it seems a little bit crazy that like copyright law was the thing, you know, like mm-hmm. that would unite the values yeah. of like the best intentioned people on the internet.
It is. Intellectual property, though, is like maybe the greatest fiction of human history.
Yeah.
Like it's such a it's such a culturally important invention, even for all its flaws. And I really, it was very instructive to me. I mean, I think anybody who knows me online knows I'm a big fan of Prince. And, you know, people know him as like, oh, a great musician or, you know, pop star or whatever. And he was all that. But to me, his career was about his reckoning with intellectual property and its place in American history, and especially its place for African-American artists, and how intellectual property had been used really to deprive African-American creators in the same way that that black people have been, you know, sort of exploited in American history so many different times in so many different ways. And for him to see that as the great work of his life to undo that, at least for himself and ideally for others, and in many ways he succeeded. And so, like, he, long story short, like, he died owning his catalog of work. And you know, that was something he spent decades working on. And you look at now, you know, the album of the year at the Grammys is Chance the Rapper. And
right.
For him to be an artist out of the Midwest, a young black man, and own his work and have never been signed to a major label, mm-hmm. is the triumph of that reckoning with what intellectual property is and the mechanism it was used as again, just robbing people already on the margins of the wealth that should, you know, and the ownership that should have been naturally accruing to them by their acts of creation. And so it's such a galvanizing and important concept, and it ties directly to social justice. And I think that's something that is not obvious because it seems esoteric. You're like, you know, the licensing on this software, what does that have to do with anything? And to me, it is as fundamental as all the other pillars of the civil rights movement of sort of broader efforts for social justice, is that ownership, equity is the whole game. And, you know, what I learned, my great grandfather marched with Gandhi, and like what I learned from my family history there was this, like, they literally wouldn't buy salt if it wasn't salt that was made by people, you know, at home in India in their community. And they wouldn't buy clothes that were imported that the, you know, the British demanded taxes and tariffs on, you know, very similar to the sort of Tea Party here in the US. But like, ownership and creation was everything. And it was like a literal principle to live and die on. And yet somehow that didn't register to me until like I had, you know, decades to look at it and learn about it and reflect on it. And you realize, like, this is sort of this repeating refrain, is like, ownership and equity in society applies to everything. And of course it applies to land. Of course it applies to property. Of course it applies to your belongings. And these are like where we built so much of law around, and why things like institutions like, you know, marriage or slavery or other things were always so unjust because of what they had to say about ownership. But this, you know, the latest vestige of that was the invisible kind of ownership you could have over intellectual property. It was something intangible that we just decided to treat as property. And when you start to do that, there's a lot of implications. I think it, of course, makes sense that when we made the most connected, most impactful network in history, it would really, really galvanize those issues around intellectual property in a way that I think we still haven't quite reckoned with.
And we're, you know, we're fairly irresponsible as human beings go. So,
you know, a kind of a mashup of what Tumblr is and a little bit of what Facebook is.
I believe that your company sold Vox.com to Vox.com.
My previous employer years ago. Gosh, this is ancient history. Back in 2002.
You know, the 6 degrees of separation of the internet.
You know, we got the glitch name from the Slack team, because, you know, their first game was Glitch, and they pivoted to being Slack, and I believe Eric might have been the one that picked the name Glitch.
Oh, this is crazy. Very fortuitous.
The internet is sometimes a very small world.
I grew up in Tokyo, so I was riding the trains around Tokyo.
And I think we're done on audio.
I kind of have this idea that, like, in the 21st century, like, the best thing that you could spend taxpayers' money on is an API. You know, this is the most, like, privileged developer-y thing to say in the world.
Yeah.
But, like, to, like, back it up a little bit and explain where I'm coming from, the choices we make about our markets impact, like, the future of everything so much.
Yes.
And so my example I always talk about is the Dwight D. Eisenhower interstate system, right?
Yes, yes. Oh, I could go for an hour on the Eisenhower highway system.
Thank you. Mm. Good. This is, like, one of my favorite government projects ever to talk about, because the choice that was made, right? This is like the classic thing of, like, America decided to invest in highways instead of railroads, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the decision to invest in highways instead of railroads leads to, like, John and I met in Chattanooga, Tennessee, right? We both went to school there. And I don't know if you know anything about Chattanooga, Tennessee, but
I've been there, but it was a long time ago.
Chattanooga has I don't know if they still do now, but when we were there, had the fastest internet in the country. And they had it because of a local municipal investment having a Spanish telco come to Chattanooga and basically, like, build out fiber to everyone's houses in Chattanooga.
But there was a lot of really interesting sort of progressive stuff, right? Like, didn't Chattanooga also have its own typeface?
They did have their own typeface. They also paid a couple of startups to move from San Francisco to Chattanooga.
Yeah, like, yeah.
They did a bunch of interesting stuff. And there was for a while they were saying...
It was a big infrastructure investment.
Yeah, for a while they were saying if you're a programmer in San Francisco or New York and you move to Chattanooga, we'll pay the down payment on your house if you live in one of these neighborhoods.
Why like, not?
It was crazy.
Go for it. Yeah.
So anyway, it's a cool, interesting town. But the really interesting thing is that all of the money that paid for all of that was mm-hmm. trucking money. Like
right.
the companies, you know, the people who are running the incubators and the venture capital and all of the interesting stuff going on in Chattanooga made their millions on trucking and infrastructure.
Wow. Okay, so they were trying to siphon highway money into internet money.
Hey, this is Future John. Just checking in to make a quick correction. Pardon the interruption. I meant to correct this in real time, but I couldn't get a word in edgewise, and then they were on a roll, and it was a good point they were making, so I didn't interrupt. But I just wanted to quickly draw attention to the fact that there are lots of cool people doing lots of cool things in Chattanooga, and that, of course, taxpayers, not this trucking company, paid for our awesome internet. I lived there for a long time. There are a lot of wonderful people doing a lot of wonderful things. One of those groups of people who is doing really cool things is this group that was called Access America, that was a logistics company, later turned into Lamppost Group, who also does very, very cool things. But of course, there are many others, and I'm just nitpicky enough that I wanted to make that point. Back to the show.
So they were virtual trucking.
Yeah.
E-trucks. So that's fascinating. in a million ways, I would pull out a couple things here. So first of all, you and I, you know, the three of us, we are talking because of the construction of the Eisenhower Highway System. Mm-hmm. And the reason being my father, is a civil, engineer. He retired after 40 years, but, he built highways for 40 years. And the reason he was able to come, so he came to the States in 63 to get his PhD at Purdue. And at that time, Indian people were not allowed to immigrate to the U.S. It didn't change until the Johnson immigration reforms in 65. But the reason he was essentially allowed to stay was because building highways was considered important to the national interest, national security. There was that pretense that you were going to land like
you were going to land
bombers
airplanes
on the highways. Yeah. And so this idea that you would be able to take off from any highway with your nuclear bomber and go and bomb Russia was really important to America.
Sure.
Why wouldn't you do that? That's a really critical skill. And so you build highways. And so it was like, whatever engineers we can get in the world, we're going to get them. And so he was allowed to stay. And then, of course, the laws changed and he you know, got his green card and later became a citizen. And he built highways for 40 years, including parts of Interstate 81 through Pennsylvania.
Awesome.
And so you know, we're like, I'm here and I'm not in that rice paddy with my cousins because America decided that it was so important to have highways. And so important to run interstates through black and brown and Jewish neighborhoods that they were going to take whatever engineers in the world would do it. And so, you know, my father was one of the first cohort of engineers that came to do that. And so that really mimicked exactly when the first wave of immigration from India and China came, you know, 50 years prior when they built the railroads.
Wow.
You know, so it's like this very interesting parallel where, like, you know, right before 1900, you have the very first Indian and Chinese immigrants. They're building the railways. The minute the railways are done, they close the door and, like, you're not allowed to immigrate anymore. And they run them off and start lynching them and burning their towns down. And then, you know, 50, 60 years later, they're like, we need highways. They're like, let them back in. And, you know, my folks came and there was a backlash. A lot of folks are too young to remember, but there were literally groups of people like cracking skulls of Asian immigrants in the 80s and this huge backlash then. You know, and they sort of like closed the door and they had a huge panic about Japan taking over and, you know, ruining the economy for America or whatever. And, mm-hmm. and that sort of takes place. And then the internet boom comes along and they're like, well, we need somebody to build this network, just like the railways and the highways. And, you know, you see all the H-1B workers in Silicon Valley coming from where? India and China. So I think it's mm-hmm. really like I get the pattern now, like third time I figured it out. Mm-hmm. And so like the highways to me epitomize the, like, the strategy by which we decide as a country what's important for us to invest in and when we're going to let people in to do it and on what terms. And it's sort of like, as long as they don't get too much leverage, we'll sort of let them in. And especially it's interesting, like in each case, it was also making sure that these highly lucrative jobs didn't go to black and Latino workers who were already here right, the US. And we've seen that in tech as well, right? And so like this pattern repeats and repeats and repeats, and yet we sort of don't see it, and we don't see a tie between, like, that was the high-tech job of the time. Mm-hmm. A skilled engineer from overseas coming to build a national network that will enable commerce, that will enable, you know, connecting the nation together. That's exactly the same pitch every single time, and yet we don't necessarily see it. And then, you know, the way it plays out is this, let's invest our profits from the last generation into this new one. I think the only example that I can think of is this one you've mentioned, where somebody who cared about making profit off of trucks is investing in the internet. I think every single other one was the opposite, where they're like, let's make sure that nothing ever succeeds in replacing trucks and cars.
One of the other things I think is so interesting about highways as a metaphor, right, is that they're an open-ish regulated platform built by the government on which companies are built, right?
I mean, there would be no McDonald's
or anything, or Walmart, or
but I mean, even the, like, you know, the idea of like the truck stop businesses directly, you know, like side of the road businesses directly. And then, of course, like the supply chain of Walmart doesn't exist without the highway investment. So, like, but even there, like, if they had had like really pervasive rail, like, Walmart would probably be cheaper.
Yeah, true.
Right, you know, like, there's a lot of things where, like, the highway system was really inefficient for the uses to which it was put, and yet we worked around it. Like, highways are a platform upon which you can do a lot of different things. You can go on vacation, you can build a business, you can, you know, build a city, you can do whatever you want to around it, within obviously the constraints of all the other challenges in society. But you know, there are things we did as platforms, and the one example of this I love is the National Weather Service, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is like, here are the data, and here's what's going to happen. And if you want to build the Weather Channel, knock yourself out. You want to build a weather app, knock yourself out. It's out there. People can use it. And even GPS, right, was this sort of like, you can use the low-res version of it, and then people figured out how to make it much more accurate, and they're like, all right, fine, keep going with it. And those things, like the value of this is billions of dollars, billions and billions of dollars for private companies. And of course, even more than that in terms of individual benefit. Like, I don't think people realize how unlikely it is that in America, you can know the weather for free.
Yeah.
Right. You can know really, really accurate weather for as far out as we can predict, days and maybe a week, maybe 10 days, in almost anywhere in America and most of the world, completely for free at any time in real time from almost any source. And the reason that's true is because it got commodified as really important civic data that we paid billions to put those satellites up. We paid billions to disseminate that information. Like, taxpayers are subsidizing to the tune of billions of dollars the infrastructure for us to all have real-time weather data. And it makes business possible. It makes events possible. It makes people having a nice wedding possible. It makes all these other things go. Transit planning, all these things are dependent on this platform of weather. And the only thing, we take it for granted because we got it right, but it is not at all hard to imagine the exact same thing if it played out today. If we had no weather satellites and we had the idea we were going to put them up today, being totally privatized, having taxes and surcharges and fees all over it, limits on how you could use the data, and monopoly players that own certain kinds of data, so all the tornado data would be from one company and we would have to pay them as the vendor that provides that to us.
It seems like a lot of these sort of newer companies are treating areas where there are holes in legislation like a feature provided by the government almost. And so, you know, the whole like, we're a market, we're not a market, like, gig economy thing had infected these people's mind. It was like, oh, if you're just providing a marketplace, then you don't have to worry about, you know, getting sued or paying benefits or doing any of these things, right? All you're doing is just providing it.
Which is to say, you've externalized all of the risk onto the platform.
Yeah, onto your not employees. Right.
Yeah.
I wonder to what extent, like, we're going to start, like, really recognizing that these things are features that we're providing to markets, you know, and, like, when we're going to start treating them like that.
Yeah, there's a couple challenges to that. I think the first is, you know, ignorance from policymakers.
Right.
So if we look just at the federal level, and we just look at Congress, let alone all the regulators and the executive branch or whatever, we look at the legislative branch, and there's 635 members of Congress. And, you know, almost none of them really have any tech literacy at all, would know how to log into a website, would know how to install an app, would know how to do anything. I mean, not build an app, just use one. And so that level of ignorance alone is the first huge barrier. The second part is, even the ones who are literate are, you know, some of them are going to be bought and paid for by interests that are not going to let us close these loopholes or capture the value that we're giving them, handing them, you know. And it's interesting because, like, we have places where we understand that value, like auctioning off, you know, spectrum, where we know that being able to broadcast at a certain frequency has a ton of value, and so we should make that something that they pay us a lot for, or that we should make it accessible and available to all like we do with Wi-Fi. And yet when we see that in similar areas, other networks, other platforms where people are trying to monetize, we just don't have the ability to capture that as a public good, a civic good. And then, of course, there is the fact that, like, there's this consensus that is so pro-corporate that we're unwilling to even entertain the idea that something should be public and should be civic-minded or owned by the people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have obviously a lot of radicals of that nature in power right now who are going to, like, deny the idea that anything shouldn't be owned by corporations. But even amongst those who are supposed to be more progressive, there's a reflexive sort of, you know, that neoliberal cant right now that everything has, where, like, everything should be mediated by a market, and a market can only be defined as a number of extremely large multi-billion dollar companies, two or three of them, splitting a market between them. And you know, I look at, like, you know, we're doing a podcast right now, and podcasting is amazingly open. There is no YouTube for podcasts. There is no one player that decides overwhelmingly whether certain ones win. Now, there are players with a lot of influence. iTunes can choose whether something does really well. Mm-hmm. Other apps can choose whether, you know, something gets some exposure. But you don't have to ask anybody to start a new podcast, and you don't have to pay anybody, you know, except for the sort of basic making the files available to have your podcast. And if you really do tell an incredible story and break out, you can do something there, and it's not beholden to one single ad network or whatever else. Those things are really open and unusual and completely different than video is online, completely different than essentially web publishing is in a world with Facebook and Google and instant articles and Google AMP in it. And yet, you know, I guess Apple just announced they're going to bring analytics to podcasts. And that's going to start to have that same skew. And that's just one area where, like, one single player being so dominant can start to flex its muscles and capture a market that was really, before it, pretty open and pretty competitive. That's in technology. We're going to see that, I think, times 1,000 in the areas we don't think of as being part of tech yet.